I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. The CBC program, as it happens, is an institution in this country. It recently celebrated its 40th anniversary on the air, and in part to mark it, a former host of the program has written a new book, The As It Happens Files, Radio That May Contain Nuts. Published by Knopf, it's a look back at what has made the show a favorite not only in this country, but around the world, looking at the news as reported on the show, such as September 11th, the death of Diana, Princess of Wales, as well as the light-hearted, eccentric stories and the people also featured, from Don Cherry to a man who wouldn't drown to the guy who grew a goddamn cabbage. Mary Lou Finley joins me now from here in Vancouver. She capped an illustrious 35-year career co-hosting As It Happens from 1997 to 2005. She's also co-hosted Live It Up, and with Barbara Frum, also a former As It Happens host, she launched the journal. The As It Happens Files retails for $32. I am pleased to welcome to the Planta on the Line program Mary Lou Finley. Good morning, Ms. Finley.
Hello, Joseph. How are you?
I'm very well. Yourself?
I'm fine, thank you.
I guess we're both coming down with colds. Did you ever do a program on colds on As It Happens?
I'm sure we've done something on colds. We must have done a cold cure at some point, but I can't quite remember the details, since none of them work.
Yeah. Well, I'm just wondering, you are a journalist. You were on radio for a long time. How do you deal with having a cold and having to talk for a living?
You know what's interesting is that in my whole 30 years, I don't remember ever not being able to go on the air because of illness. My worst affliction was migraines at one point, but I didn't have a lot of them until the very last few months that I was working, and I got laryngitis, and it hit me in the middle of the day. So we had taped, you know, sort of like half the show, because we do the interviews all through the day. All the material is collected during the day for the hour and a half that we're on the air in the evening, and half of it was done, and suddenly I opened my mouth, nothing came out.
Right.
Uh-oh. We haven't had this problem before. What are we going to do? So, I went and I took some tea and honey and forced myself, croaked out noise for that rest of the day. And then I had to take 2 days off because I had no voice.
What makes this show? What makes As It Happens? So you had to break it down into a recipe. What, you know, I guess it's the current affairs part of it,
yeah.
And then it's sort of the sort of lighthearted, eccentric stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, it is like a recipe, or more perhaps, you know, like a full, well-rounded meal. So you've got your meat and potatoes, your important national, international stories that people are interested in and have to know about, want to know about. And then you have, you have some interesting veggies, which might be stories about science and health and medicine. And then you've got dessert, which may be music and musicians and some art. And I guess you've got some little spices along the way, eccentrics and that sort of thing.
And it seems like you all had fun doing it over the 40 years, all the hosts and stuff. And you yourself, after reading the book, had fun putting the show together.
We did. You know, on the last day that I was there, my staff surprised me by running clips from an interview that I did with Barbara Frum, who was one of the first hosts of As It Happens nearly 40 years ago. And I was doing a television show in 1997, and she was hosting As It Happens, and I asked her, I said, "You sound as though you're having fun." And she said, "Well, We have to be having fun because everybody works really hard, and if we weren't having fun, I don't know how we would sustain it." But and it's true. Nothing had changed. Everybody works really hard, and we have a lot of fun doing it.
See, I don't listen to the show, but I have listened to it after reading the book and preparing for this. I'm a creature of private radio, I guess. I idolized Rafe Mayer. I listen to IMIS every day.
Right.
And for radio, for music and news, I go to the commercial station.
Mm-hmm.
Who makes the audience up for As It Happens?
Well, the audience is everybody everywhere. We have, I've had children of, 8 and 9 years old write to us or come to the studio to meet us and write up, on their grandparents. It's across the country. It's from the north. I mean, this before the internet, we had listeners in Finland and all across the United States and around the world on shortwave. So the audience is very widespread and very diverse.
Will the show go on forever?
I don't see why not. And I'm quite serious, because it's the structure of it is so flexible. It can be really anything you want. I mean, it's basically a phone and a radio transmitter, and enough people to hit the phones and to chase down the guests. You know, there were phone out shows. There were always what my friends used to call open mouth shows, where the host sits there and all manner of people phone in. Some of them are great, and some of them are just really stupid. But this show was designed as you were going to call out and talk to the people you wanted to talk to about the stories of the day. And nobody has really copied that formula. I think one of the reasons is that it's expensive, because it takes a lot of people to track down, you know, the foreign minister of Guinea-Bissau on the day of the coup. And that's the sort of thing that, as it happens, will do, not just the silly things.
And with the advent of the cell phone, was it easier to get people?
Well, it is. It's much easier. Before cell phones and before people could easily find numbers, the calls all had to be placed through bell operators in the early days. And there are great stories that the old producers have to tell about the bell operators who felt that they were part of the production team. And George Jameson, who was still the senior producer of the program when I joined it in 1997, had been there at that time. He remembers calling an operator one day and asking for a number for, you know, the palace or the president's house in Nigeria or something. And the operator said, "Oh, it's usually Mr. Summerwell who does Africa. I hope he's not ill." So they were very much part of the team. And then, then things changed, and there are internets to find phone numbers and cell phones. But, of course, the great thing is that everybody has cell phones everywhere. Now you talk to people in the middle of the revolution, the Orange Revolution, in the middle of the square. And also, people speak English everywhere in the world. It's quite remarkable. There's always someone who speaks English, except parts of France.
Right, yeah. Well, where's Reading?
Reading,
pardon me.
Yes, Reading. Reading is about 30 miles west of London, just up the Thames, or down the Thames, which would it be? It would be up the Thames, to the left of London.
Yeah, and this is a city in London,
yes,
that has been referred to on the program for, I don't know how many, for nearly 40 years, has it?
Not quite that long, no, but quite a long time. And it just started as a silly thing. There was one of those stories about a British eccentric that the show has always had a fondness for. And the producer, who had just recently joined the show, came from England. And the producer of that particular item. And when the executive, and he'd written the script, and he'd said, you know, we've just talked to the man with the talking duck from, and he named the place, you know, Little Cove, you know, Little Hastings, wherever. And the executive producer said, well, nobody knows where that is, so tell us where that is. And the producer, who had come from the area, thought, well, I'll name the biggest town in the area. It's, you know, 3 miles north of Reading. And after Al Maitland read the script, the producer, the executive producer, came storming out of the studio and said, where the hell is Reading? And all the rest of the staff laughed. So for the next few days, every time they had a story from England, they identified it as to its distance, you know, by telling its distance from Reading, just because it made them all laugh. And then they never stopped. And it drives at least one listener completely around the bend. And every time he hears it, he rushes to the phone and he calls us up and he says, you stupid, stupid, stupid people, when are you going to stop these stupid references to stupid Reading? And that just gets people laughing even harder, the producers, I mean. So it just never stops, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and your April Fool's jokes that you put.
Yeah.
People like those, or do they get upset as well?
They don't get upset at the joke, but they sometimes get upset at what they think is the truth. One time we got a president of the CBC, Perrin Beatty then at the time, we asked him if he would help us play an April Fool's joke, and we would pretend that the show was going to be sponsored by Disney, which you may remember the RCMP toys
were
all being put out by Disney or something. They'd worked out a deal with them. That wasn't that far-fetched. You know, that's the secret about an April Fool's joke. It has to be almost even just plausible.
Yeah.
Awful and shocking and horrible, but plausible. So he was great. We didn't give him a script. We just said, here's the situation. We're going to be funded by Disney. And he made it so believable that it actually made us frightened that maybe we were going to be taken over by Disney.
Yeah, yeah.
But, so I mean, the audience, some of them are very outraged about that. But then Barbara Frum, who was off one time with a broken leg.
Barbara Budd.
Thank you. My co-host. People were wanting to know why wasn't she on the show? They would call in and say, where's Barbara Budd? And we hadn't said anything, and she didn't want people to know she was home with a broken leg. So she said one day, just before April 1st, she said, call me tomorrow, and I'll tell you. So that was it. That was all I knew. I called her, and I said, hi, Barbara. I said, people have been asking about you. I knew she had a broken leg, of course. But I said, so where are you? And she said, well, where do you think any as-it-happens girl would be if she could be? And, of course, I said, Reading. And she said, that's where I am. And then she explained that she'd been given a Canada Council grant to go around the world and visit all the places she had mispronounced on the air. Well, that drove some of the listeners just also wild, right?
Yeah.
Our taxpayers' dollars are going to send Barbara Budd around the world for places she's mispronounced. That's it. You know, I'm leaving this country.
Yeah.
It was lovely. One person at least thought it was a lovely way to spend our money.
In the book is a transcript of an interview you did with Don Cherry.
Yes.
Reads awfully contentious, was it?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, it's Don.
Yeah.
You got to take everything with a grain of salt. We called him up one day because he was coaching a AAA hockey team that was last in the league and had been for 5 years in a row. And so, you know, I mean, he's always going on about how he knows everything about hockey, so I wanted to know why he couldn't coach a hockey team. And he started out really nice and singing, you know, Hello, Mary Lou, I Love You, and all that. And then as I kept asking questions about losing hockey team, he did get really, really irritated. But again, until he got to the point where he said, you know, well, what's wrong with me? Well, you know, it's like you, you know, sometimes, you know, you're really good at your job, but you're just in a bad situation. Like you're probably a really good journalist, but there you are in some show that's on in the middle of the afternoon and only has 3 listeners. So we put it on the air, and people started calling in, and so, you know, half the people who called said, you know, my husband and I are driving down the 401. We're laughing our heads off. I guess we're 2 of your 3 listeners. I loved that. Actually, I had fun with that interview, and everybody liked it.
Had you seen him afterwards?
I haven't. He must be on a book tour somewhere, because he's got a book out.
Yeah, I think he does, yeah.
We'll probably end up in the same studio someday.
How did this book come about?
It came about because I realized after I left the show that it had such a following, this program. Everybody just kept wanting to talk about As It Happens and what was it like to do the program and who were your favorite interviews. Well, it was hard to answer those questions because I had done like 10,000 interviews in the 8 years I was there. But I did have a few favorites that clearly I liked remembering, and I thought, well, Maybe I'll remember them. I'll start to think about them and tell those stories over again. And then I hit on the idea of doing updates on some of the interviews. So the book is a bit of behind the scenes about how we put the show together and who some of those people are, like Barbara Budd and who the writers are for the program. It's also some of the interesting guests and the big stories like 9/11 and the Iraq War and Air India. And it's updates with a lot of people.
And it seems like you had fun putting it together, did you?
Well, I did, you know, as much as writing a book can be fun. Have you written a book?
No.
Well, it's really fun when it's flowing.
Yeah.
And it's hell the rest of the time.
Yeah, but it seems like you had to listen to some of the old programs again. And that must have been fun.
It was fun. I spent a lot of time in the archives listening to shows from right across the last 8 years and all kinds of material that I had completely forgotten about. So that was great fun.
Now, Barbara Frum wrote a book as well, didn't she?
Yeah.
As It Happened.
Yes.
And that was about the show as well, right?
That's why I was interviewing her in 1997. She had
87.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And no, 77.
77.
Did I say, 97. 1977, I interviewed her. I was doing a TV show, and she was hosting As It Happened.
Was this a show that you listened to before? You obviously did before you joined it, right?
For many years.
And you still listen to it today?
Yep, absolutely, yeah. It's just had its 40th anniversary, and that was the other thing that I reasoned for doing the book. I thought it would be a good time to bring another book out, because nothing had been written since 1977.
Do you miss it at all?
I do. I miss the people, both on the air and in the office, in the studio. But I also, when, you know, it's minus 30 and blowing snow, the snow's going sideways outside my window, I'm really glad I don't have to go out. I don't want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you spend most of your time now? Are you retired?
Well, I'm just sort of doing different things, I guess. Writing books is one, and that's fairly time-consuming.
Well, what other books are you working on?
Well, I haven't sold them yet.
Ah, okay.
I haven't pitched them yet.
Yeah. And well, one of the other things that I found fascinating was that As It Happens was one of the first shows to talk about Darfur, and that was during your time, is that right?
Yes.
And on subjects like that, other than the eccentric stuff, it was important to shed light on important stories of the day.
Because
that's essentially what it is, a current affairs show, mm-hmm. right? Is that something that you're proud of particularly?
Well, I guess it's just something you feel that you should be doing. I don't know if proud is the right word. You know, yes, as soon as we saw the reports, the early reports from the head of humanitarian affairs, I think it was April 1994, about a bad situation beginning to unfold in Darfur, we said, this is not going to be another Rwanda. It's going to get lots of coverage ahead of time. As It Happens, by the way, had done daily interviews with Romeo Dallaire in Rwanda, while the massacre was unfolding. But that news came rather late to the world, you know, that there was a bad situation in Rwanda and there was no help to be had in time. And we thought, well, there'll be lots of time for Darfur. But, you know, here we are, 2008, and they're still dying, and the situation is awful, and there still isn't an adequate UN force there. Because, you know, people say, oh, the UN has to do something, but the UN is us. It's every other country in the world. And so if we don't step up to the plate, and I'm not blaming anybody for not doing it either, because I don't know what the answer is to these situations, frankly.
Why did you leave the show? It's been 3 years now, has it?
Mm-hmm. I just felt it was time, James. I just, I was beginning to get tired. It's as much fun as it is and as engrossing as it is to host. It's also, it uses up a lot of energy. So I felt that it was probably time for somebody fresh to come in and take the helm before I got completely exhausted.
This is a wonderful book, and congratulations on doing it. Continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
The book is called The As It Happens Files, Radio That May Contain Nuts. Mary Lou Finley is the author. $32 from Knopf. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Plato.
Nice to talk to you. Did I call you James?
Hey, you did, yes.
I'm very sorry.
No, that's
fine. Thank you, Joseph.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Okay.
Okay, have a good day. Bye-bye.